The Phantom Tollbooth, Disc 2.
Chapter 6. Faintly Macabre's Story. Once upon a time, this land was a barren and frightening wilderness whose high rocky mountains sheltered the evil winds and whose barren valleys offered hospitality to no man. Few things grew, and those that did were bent and twisted, and their fruit was as bitter as wormwood. What wasn't waste was desert, and what wasn't desert was rock, and the demons of darkness made their home in the hills. Evil creatures roamed at will through the countryside and down to the sea. It was known as the Land of Null. Then, one day, a small ship appeared on the Sea of Knowledge. It carried a young prince seeking the future. In the name of goodness and truth, he laid claim to all the country and set out to explore his new domain. The demons, monsters, and giants were furious at his presumption and banded together to drive him out. The earth shook with their battle. And when they'd finished, all that remained to the prince was a small piece of land at the edge of the sea. "I'll build my city here," he declared, and that is what he did. Before long, more ships came bearing settlers for the new land, and the city grew and pushed its boundaries farther and farther out. Each day it was attacked anew, but nothing could destroy the prince's new city. And grow it did. Soon it was no longer just a city. It was a kingdom. But outside the walls all was not safe, and the new king vowed to conquer the land that was rightfully his. So each spring he set forth with his army, and each autumn he returned, and year by year the kingdom grew larger and more prosperous. He took to himself a wife, and before long had two fine young sons, to whom he taught everything he knew, so that one day they might rule wisely. When the boys grew to young manhood, the king called them to him and said, "I am becoming an old man and can no longer go forth to battle. You must take my place and found new cities in the wilderness, for the kingdom of wisdom must grow." And so they did. One went south to the foothills of confusion and built Dictionopolis, the city of words. And one went north to the mountains of ignorance and built Digitopolis, the city of numbers. Both cities flourished mightily, and the demons were driven back still further. Soon other cities and towns were founded in the new lands, and at last only the farthest reaches of the wilderness remained to these terrible creatures. And there they waited, ready to strike down all who ventured near or relaxed their guard. The two brothers were glad, however, to go their separate ways, for they were by nature very suspicious and jealous. Each one tried to outdo the other, and they worked so hard and diligently at it that before long their cities rivaled even wisdom in size and grandeur. "Words are more important than wisdom," said one privately. "Numbers are more important than wisdom," thought the other to himself. And they grew to dislike each other more and more. The old king, however, who knew nothing of his son's animosity, was very happy in the twilight of his reign, and spent his days quietly walking and contemplating in the royal gardens. His only regret was that he'd never had a daughter, for he loved little girls as much as he loved little boys. One day, As he was strolling peacefully about the grounds, he discovered two tiny babies that had been abandoned in a basket under the grape arbor. They were beautiful, golden-haired girls. The king was overjoyed. "They have been sent to crown my old age," he cried, and called the queen, his ministers, the palace staff, and indeed the entire population to see them. "We'll call this one Rhyme and this one Reason," he said. And so they became the Princess of Sweet Rhyme and the Princess of Pure Reason, and were brought up in the palace. When the old king finally died, the kingdom was divided between his two sons, with the provision that they would be equally responsible for the welfare of the young princesses. One son went south and became Azaz, the unabridged king of Dictionopolis, and the other went north and became the mathemagician, ruler of Digitopolis. And true to their words, they both provided well for the little girls, who continued to live in wisdom. Everyone loved the princesses because of their great beauty, their gentle ways, and their ability to settle all controversies fairly and reasonably. People with problems or grievances or arguments came from all over the land to seek advice. And even the two brothers, who by this time were fighting continuously, often called upon them to help decide matters of state. It was said by everyone that rhyme and reason answer all problems. As the years passed, the two brothers grew farther and farther apart, and their separate kingdoms became richer and grander. Their disputes, however, became more and more difficult to reconcile. But always, with patience and love, the princesses set things right. Then, one day, they had the most terrible quarrel of all. King Azaz insisted that words were far more significant than numbers, and hence his kingdom was truly the greater. And the mathemagician claimed that numbers were much more important than words, and hence his kingdom was supreme. They discussed and debated and raved and ranted until they were on the verge of blows, when it was decided to submit the question to arbitration by the princesses. After days of careful consideration, in which all the evidence was weighed and all the witnesses heard, they made their decision. Words and numbers are of equal value, for in the cloak of knowledge one is warp and the other woof. It is no more important to count the sands than it is to name the stars. Therefore, let both kingdoms live in peace. Everyone was pleased with the verdict. Everyone, that is, but the brothers, who were beside themselves with anger. "What good are these girls if they cannot settle an argument in someone's favor?" they growled, since both were more interested in their own advantage than in the truth. "We'll banish them from the kingdom forever." And so they were taken from the palace and sent far away to the castle in the air, and they haven't been seen since. That's why today, in all this land, there's neither rhyme nor reason.
"And what happened to the two rulers?" asked Milo.
"Banishing the two princesses was the last thing they ever agreed upon, and they soon fell to warring with each other. Despite this, their own kingdoms have continued to prosper. But the old city of wisdom has fallen into great disrepair, and there is no one to set things right. So you see, until the princesses return, I shall have to stay here.
Maybe we can rescue them, said Milo as he saw how sad the witch looked.
Oh, that would be difficult, she replied. The castle in the air is far from here, and the one stairway which leads to it is guarded by fierce and black-hearted demons.
Tuck growled ominously, for he hated even the thought of demons.
I'm afraid there's not much a little boy and a dog can do, she said. But never you mind. It's not so bad. I've grown quite used to it here. But you must be going, or else you'll waste the whole day.
Oh, we're here for 6 million years, sighed Milo, and I don't see any way to escape.
Nonsense, scolded the witch. You mustn't take Officer Shrift so seriously. He loves to put people in prison, but he doesn't care about keeping them there. Now just press that button in the wall and be on your way.
Milo pressed the button, and a door swung open, letting in a shaft of brilliant sunshine.
Goodbye. Come again,
shouted the witch, as they stepped outside and the door slammed shut. Milo and Tuck stood blinking in the bright light, and as their eyes became accustomed to it, the first things they saw were the king's advisers again rushing toward them.
Ah, there you are.
Where have you been?
They've been looking all over for you.
The royal banquet is about to begin.
Come with us.
They seemed very agitated and out of breath as Milo walked along with them.
But what about my car? He asked.
Don't need it, replied the Duke.
No use for it, said the minister.
Superfluous, advised the Count.
Unnecessary, stated the Earl.
Uncalled for, cried the Undersecretary. We'll take our vehicle.
Conveyance.
Rig. Sharabang. Chariot.
Buggy.
Coach.
Brougham. Chandradan,
they repeated quickly in order, and pointed to a small wooden wagon.
Oh, dear, all those words again, thought Milo, as he climbed into the wagon with Tuck and the cabinet members. How are you going to make it move? It doesn't have a...
Be very quiet, advised the Duke, for it goes without saying.
And sure enough, as soon as they were all quite still, it began to move quickly through the streets, and in a very short time they arrived at the royal palace. Chapter 7. The Royal Banquet.
Right this way.
Follow us.
Come along.
Step lively.
Here we go,
they shouted, hopping from the wagon and bounding up the broad marble stairway. Milo and Tuck followed close behind. It was a strange-looking palace, and if he didn't know better, he would have said that it looked exactly like an enormous book, standing on end, with its front door in the lower part of the binding, just where they usually place the publisher's name. Once inside, they hurried down a long hallway, which glittered with crystal chandeliers and echoed with their footsteps. The walls and ceiling were covered with mirrors, whose reflections danced dizzily along with them, and the footman bowed coldly.
"We must be terribly late,"
gasped the Earl, nervously, as they reached the tall doors of the banquet hall. It was a vast room full of people loudly talking and arguing. The long table was carefully set with gold plates and linen napkins. An attendant stood behind each chair, and at the center, raised slightly above the others, was a throne covered in crimson cloth. Directly behind, on the wall, was the royal coat of arms, flanked by the flags of Dictionopolis. Milo noticed many of the people he'd seen in the marketplace. The letterman was busy explaining to an interested group the history of the W, and off in a corner, the humbug and the spelling bee were arguing fiercely about nothing at all. Officer Schrift wandered through the crowd, suspiciously muttering,
"Guilty. Guilty. They're all guilty."
And on noticing Milo, brightened visibly, and commented in passing,
"Is it 6 million years already? My, how time flies."
Everyone seemed quite grumpy about having to wait for lunch, and they were all relieved to see the tardy guests arrive.
"Certainly glad you finally made it, old man," said the humbug, cordially pumping Milo's hand. "As guest of honor, you must choose the menu, of course."
"Oh, my," he thought, not knowing what to say.
"Be quick about it," suggested the spelling bee. "I'm famished, F-A-M-I-S-H-E-D.
As Milo tried to think, there was an ear-shattering blast of trumpets, entirely off-key, and a page announced to the startled guests,
"King Azaz the Unabridged."
The king strode through the door and over to the table and settled his great bulk onto the throne, calling irritably,
"Places, everyone, take your places."
He was the largest man Milo had ever seen, with a great stomach, large, piercing eyes, a gray beard that reached to his waist, and a silver signet ring on the little finger of his left hand. He also wore a small crown and a robe with the letters of the alphabet beautifully embroidered all over it.
"What have we here?" he said, staring down at Tuck and Milo as everyone else took his place.
"If you please," said Milo, "my name is Milo, and this is Tuck. Thank you very much for inviting us to your banquet, and I think your palace is beautiful."
"Exquisite," corrected the Duke.
"Lovely," counseled the minister.
"Handsome," recommended the Count.
"Pretty,"
hinted the Earl.
"Charming," submitted the Undersecretary. "Silence," suggested the King. "Now, young man, what can you do to entertain us? Sing songs, tell stories, compose sonnets, juggle plates, do tumbling tricks? Which is it?"
"I can't do any of those things," admitted Milo.
"What an ordinary little boy," commented the King. "Why, my cabinet members can do all sorts of things. The Duke here can make mountains out of molehills. The minister splits hairs. The Count makes hay while the sun shines. The Earl leaves no stone unturned. And the Undersecretary," he finished ominously, "hangs by a thread. Can't you do anything at all?"
"I can count to 1,000, offered Milo.
"Ah, numbers. Never mention numbers here. Only use them when we absolutely have to," growled Azaz disgustedly. "Now, why don't you and Tuck come up here and sit next to me, and we'll have some dinner." "Are you ready with the menu?" reminded the humbug.
"Well," said Milo, remembering that his mother had always told him to eat lightly when he was a guest, "why don't we have a light meal?"
"A light meal it'll be," roared the bug, waving his arms.
The waiters rushed in, carrying large serving platters, and set them on the table in front of the king. When he lifted the covers, shafts of brilliant colored light leaped from the plates and bounced around the ceiling, the walls, across the floor, and out the windows.
"Not a very substantial meal," said the humbug, rubbing his eyes, "but quite an attractive one. Perhaps you can suggest something a little more filling."
The king clapped his hands. The platters were removed, and without thinking, Milo quickly suggested,
"Well, in that case, I think we ought to have a square meal of..."
"A square meal it is," shouted the humbug again.
The king clapped his hands once more, and the waiters reappeared, carrying plates heaped high with steaming squares of all sizes and colors. Ugh, said the spelling bee, tasting one. These are awful.
No one else seemed to like them very much either, and the humbug got one caught in his throat and almost choked.
Time for the speeches, announced the king, as the plates were again removed and everyone looked glum. You first, he commanded, pointing to Milo.
Your Majesty, ladies and gentlemen, started Milo timidly, I would like to take this opportunity to say that in all the...
That's quite enough, snapped the king. Mustn't talk all day.
But I'd just begun, objected Milo.
Next,
bellowed the king.
Roast turkey, mashed potatoes, vanilla ice cream, recited the humbug, bouncing up and down quickly.
What a strange speech, thought Milo,
for he'd heard many in the past, and knew that they were supposed to be long and dull.
Hamburgers, corn on the cob, chocolate pudding, P-U-D-D-I-N-G, said the spelling bee in his turn.
Frankfurters, sour pickles, strawberry jam, shouted Officer Schrift from his chair.
Since he was taller sitting than standing, he didn't bother to get up. And so, down the line it went, with each guest rising briefly, making a short speech, and then resuming his place. When everyone had finished, the king rose.
Pâté de foie gras, soupe à l'oignon, faisant sous cloche, salade endive, fromage et fruits et demi-tasse, he said carefully and clapped his hands again.
The waiters reappeared immediately, carrying heavy, hot trays, which they set on the table. Each one contained the exact word spoken by the various guests, and they all began eating immediately with great gusto.
Dig in, said the king, poking Milo with his elbow and looking disapprovingly at his plate. I can't say that I think much of your choice.
I didn't know that I was going to have to eat my words, objected Milo.
Of course, everyone here does, the king grunted. You should have made a tastier speech.
Milo looked around at everyone busily stuffing himself, and then back at his own unappetizing plate. It certainly didn't look worth eating, and he was so very hungry.
Here, try some summer salt, suggested the Duke. It improves the flavor.
Have a rigmarole, offered the Count, passing the bread basket. A ragamuffin, seconded the minister.
Perhaps you'd care for a synonym bun, suggested the Duke.
Why not wait for your just desserts?
Mumbled the Earl indistinctly, his mouth full of food.
How many times must I tell you not to bite off more than you can chew? Snapped the Undersecretary, patting the distressed Earl on the back. In one ear and out the other, scolded the Duke, attempting to stuff one of his words through the Earl's head.
If it isn't one thing, it's another, chided the minister.
Out of the frying pan, into the fire, shouted the Count, burning himself badly.
Well, you don't have to bite my head off, screamed the terrified Earl, and flew at the others in a rage.
The five of them scuffled wildly under the table.
Stop that at once, thundered Azaz, or I'll banish the lot of you. Sorry?
Excuse me.
Forgive us.
Pardon.
Regrets,
they apologized in turn, and sat down glaring at each other. The rest of the meal was finished in silence, until the king, wiping the gravy stains from his vest, called for dessert. Milo, who'd not eaten anything, looked up eagerly.
We're having a special treat today, said the king,
as the delicious smell of homemade pastry filled the banquet hall.
By royal command, the pastry chefs have worked all night in the half-bakery to make sure that...
The half-bakery? Questioned Milo.
Of course the half-bakery, snapped the king. Where do you think half-baked ideas come from? Now please don't interrupt. By royal command, the pastry chefs have worked all night to...
What's a half-baked idea?
Asked Milo again.
Will you be quiet?
Growled Azaz angrily. But before he could begin again, three large serving carts were wheeled into the hall, and everyone jumped up to help himself.
They're very tasty, explained the humbug, but they don't always agree with you. Here's one that's very good.
He handed it to Milo, and through the icing and nuts, Milo saw that it said, "The earth is flat."
"People swallowed that one for years," commented the spelling bee. "But it's not very popular these days, D-A-Y-S."
He picked up a long one that stated, "The moon is made of green cheese," and hungrily bit off the part that said cheese.
"Now there's a half-baked idea," he said, smiling.
Milo looked at the great assortment of cakes, which were being eaten almost as quickly as anyone could read them. The Count was munching contentedly on "It Never Rains, But It Pours," and the King was busy slicing one that stated, "Night air is bad air."
"I wouldn't eat too many of those if I were you," advised Tuck. "They may look good, but you can get terribly sick of them."
"Don't worry," Milo replied. "I'll just wrap one up for later." And he folded his napkin around, "Everything happens for the best." Chapter 8. The Humbug Volunteers.
"Couldn't eat another thing," puffed the Duke, clutching his stomach.
"Oh, my, oh, dear," agreed the minister, breathing with great difficulty.
Mumbled the Earl, desperately trying to swallow another mouthful.
"Thoroughly stuffed," sighed the Count, loosening his belt.
"Full up," grunted the undersecretary, reaching for the last cake.
As everyone finished, the only sounds to be heard were the creaking of chairs, the pushing of plates, the licking of spoons, and, of course, a few words from the humbug.
"A delightful repast, delicately prepared and elegantly served," he announced, to no one in particular. "A feast of rare bouquet. My compliments to the chef. By all means, my compliments to the chef."
Then, with a most distressed look on his face, he turned to Milo and gasped,
"Would you kindly fetch me a glass of water? I seem to have a touch of indigestion."
"Perhaps you've eaten too much too quickly," Milo remarked sympathetically.
"Too much too quickly, too much too quickly," wheezed the uncomfortable bug between gulps. "To be sure, too much too quickly. I most certainly should have eaten too little too slowly, or too much too slowly, or too little too quickly, or taken all day to eat nothing, or eaten everything in no time at all, or occasionally eaten something any time, or perhaps I should have..."
And he toppled back, exhausted, into his chair, and continued to mumble indistinctly.
"Attention, attention, let me have your attention," insisted the King, leaping to his feet and pounding the table.
The command was entirely unnecessary, for the moment he began to speak, everyone but Milo, Tuck, and the distraught bug rushed from the hall, down the stairs, and out of the palace.
"Loyal subjects and friends," continued Azaz, his voice echoing in the almost empty room. "Once again, on this gala occasion, we have..."
"Pardon me," coughed Milo as politely as possible, "but everyone is gone."
"I was hoping no one would notice," said the King sadly. "It happens every time."
"They've all gone to dinner," announced the humbug weakly, "and just as soon as I catch my breath, I shall join them."
"That's ridiculous. How can they eat dinner right after a banquet?" asked Milo.
"Scandalous," shouted the King. "We'll put a stop to it at once. From now on, by royal command, everyone must eat dinner before the banquet."
"But that's just as bad," protested Milo.
"You mean just as good," corrected the humbug.
"Things which are equally bad are also equally good. Try to look at the bright side of things."
I don't know which side of anything to look at, protested Milo. Everything's so confusing, and all your words only make things worse.
How true, said the unhappy king, resting his regal chin on his royal fist, as he thought fondly of the old days. There must be something we can do about it.
Pass a law, the humbug suggested brightly.
We have almost as many laws as words, grumbled the king.
Offer a reward, offered the bug again.
The king shook his head and looked sadder and sadder.
Send for help. Drive a bargain. Pull the switch. File a brief. Lower the boom. Tow the line. Raise the bridge. Bar the door, shouted the bug, jumping up and down, waving his arms.
Then he promptly sat down as the king glanced furiously in his direction.
Perhaps you might allow rhyme and reason to return, said Milo softly, for he'd been waiting for just such an opportunity to suggest it.
How nice that would be, said Azaz, straightening up and adjusting his crown. Even if they were a bother at times, things always went so well when they were here.
As he spoke, he leaned back on the throne, clasped his hands behind his head, and stared thoughtfully at the ceiling.
But I'm afraid it can't be done. Certainly not, it can't be done, repeated the humbug.
Why not? Asked Milo.
Why not, indeed? Exclaimed the bug,
who seemed equally at home on either side of an argument.
Much too difficult, replied the king.
Of course, emphasized the bug, much too difficult.
You could if you really wanted to, insisted Milo.
By all means, if you really wanted to, you could, the humbug agreed.
How? Asked Azaz, glaring at the bug.
How? Inquired Milo, looking the same way.
A simple task, began the humbug, suddenly wishing he were somewhere else. For a brave lad with a stout heart, a steadfast dog, and a serviceable small automobile. Go on, commanded the king.
Yes, please, seconded Milo.
All that he'd have to do, continued the worried bug, is travel through miles of harrowing and hazardous countryside, into unknown valleys and uncharted forests, past yawning chasms and trackless wastes, until he reached Digitopolis, if, of course, he ever reached there. Then he'd have to persuade the mathematician to agree to release the little princesses, and, of course, he'd never agree to anything that you agreed with. And anyway, if he did, you certainly wouldn't agree to it. From there, it's a simple matter of entering the mountains of ignorance, full of perilous pitfalls and ominous overtones, a land to which many venture but few return, and whose evil demons slither slowly from peak to peak in search of prey. Then an effortless climb up a 2,000-step circular stairway without railings in a high wind at night, for in those mountains it's always night, to the castle in the air. He paused momentarily for breath, then began again. After a pleasant chat with the princesses, all that remains is a leisurely ride back through those chaotic crags whose frightening fiends have sworn to tear any intruder limb from limb and devour him down to his belt buckle. And finally, after the long ride back, a triumphal parade, if of course there's anything left to parade, followed by hot chocolate and cookies for everyone. The humbug bowed low and sat down once again, very pleased with himself. "I never realized it would be so simple," said the king, stroking his beard and smiling broadly.
"Quite simple indeed," concurred the bug.
"It sounds dangerous to me," said Milo.
"Most dangerous," mumbled the humbug, still trying to be in agreement with everybody.
"Who'll make the journey?" asked Tok,
who'd been listening very carefully to the humbug's description.
A very good question, replied the king. But there's one far more serious problem.
What is it? Asked Milo, who was rather unhappy at the turn the conversation had taken.
I'm afraid I can tell you that only when you return, cried the king, clapping his hands three times.
As he did so, the waiters rushed back into the room and quickly cleared away the dishes, the silver, the tablecloth, the table, the chairs, the banquet hall, and the palace, leaving them all suddenly standing in the marketplace.
Of course, you realize that I'd like to make the trip myself, continued Azaz, striding across the square as if nothing had happened. But since it was your idea, you'll have all the honor and fame.
But you see, began Milo.
Dictionopolis will always be grateful, my boy, interrupted the king, throwing one arm around Milo and patting Tok with the other. You'll face many dangers on your journey, but fear not, for I've brought you this for your protection.
He drew from inside his cape a small, heavy box about the size of a schoolbook and handed it ceremoniously to Milo.
In this box are all the words I know, he said. Most of them you'll never need. Some you'll use constantly. But with them you may ask all the questions which have never been answered and answer all the questions which have never been asked. All the great books of the past and all the ones yet to come are made with these words. With them, there's no obstacle you can't overcome. All you must learn to do is use them well and in the right places.
Milo accepted the gift with thanks, and the little group walked to the car, still parked at the edge of the square.
You will, of course, need a guide, said the king. And since he knows the obstacles so well, the humbug has cheerfully volunteered to accompany you.
Now see here,
cried the startled bug, for that was the last thing in the world he wanted to do.
You'll find him dependable, brave, resourceful, and loyal, continued Azaz,
and the humbug was so overcome by the flattery that he quite forgot to object again.
I'm sure he'll be a great help, cried Milo, as they drove across the square.
I hope so, thought Tok to himself,
for he was far less sure.
Good luck! Good luck! Do be careful!
Shouted the king, and down the road they went. Milo and Tok wondered what strange adventures lay ahead. The humbug speculated on how he'd ever become involved in such a hazardous undertaking. And the crowd waved and cheered wildly, for while they didn't care at all about anyone arriving, they were always very pleased to see someone go. Chapter 9. It's All in How You Look at Things. Soon, all traces of Dictionopolis had vanished in the distance, and all those strange and unknown lands that lay between the kingdom of words and the kingdom of numbers stretched before them. It was late afternoon, and the dark orange sun floated heavily over the distant mountains. A friendly, cool breeze slapped playfully at the car, and the long shadows stretched out lazily from the trees and bushes.
Ah, the open road, exclaimed the humbug, breathing deeply,
for now he seemed happily resigned to the trip.
The spirit of adventure, the lure of the unknown, the thrill of a gallant quest, how very grand indeed.
Then, pleased with himself, he folded his arms, sat back, and left it at that. In a few more minutes, they had left the open countryside and driven into a dense forest. This is the scenic route, straight ahead to Point of View, announced a rather large road sign. But contrary to its statement, all that could be seen were more trees. As the car rushed along, the trees grew thicker and taller and leafier, until, just as they'd hidden the sky completely, the forest abruptly ended, and the road bent itself around a broad promontory. Stretching below, to the left, the right, and straight ahead, as far as anyone could see, lay the rich, green landscape through which they'd been traveling.
"Remarkable view," announced the humbug, bouncing from the car as if he were responsible for the whole thing.
"Isn't it beautiful?" gasped Milo.
"Oh, I don't know,"
answered a strange voice.
"It's all in the way you look at things."
"I beg your pardon?" said Milo, for he didn't see who'd spoken.
"I said it's all in how you look at things,"
repeated the voice. Milo turned around and found himself staring at two very neatly polished brown shoes, for standing directly in front of him, if you can use the word standing for anyone suspended in mid-air, was another boy just about his age, whose feet were easily 3 feet off the ground.
"For instance," continued the boy, "if you happen to like deserts, you might not think this was beautiful at all."
"That's true," said the humbug, who didn't like to contradict anyone whose feet were that far off the ground.
"For instance," said the boy again, "if Christmas trees were people, and people were Christmas trees, we'd all be chopped down, put up in the living room, and covered with tinsel while the trees opened our presents."
"What does that have to do with it?" asked Milo.
"Nothing at all," he answered, "but it's an interesting possibility, don't you think?"
"How do you manage to stand up there?" asked Milo,
for this was the subject which most interested him.
"I was about to ask you a similar question," answered the boy, "for you must be much older than you look to be standing on the ground."
"What do you mean?" Milo asked.
"Well," said the boy, "in my family, everyone's born in the air with his head at exactly the height it's going to be when he's an adult, and then we all grow toward the ground. When we're fully grown up, or, as you can see, grown down, our feet finally touch. Of course, there are a few of us whose feet never reach the ground, no matter how old we get, but I suppose it's the same in every family." He hopped a few steps in the air, skipped back to where he started, and then began again. "You certainly must be very old to have reached the ground already."
"Oh, no," said Milo seriously. "In my family, we all start on the ground and grow up, and we never know how far until we actually get there."
"What a silly system,"
the boy laughed.
"Then your head keeps changing its height, and you always see things in a different way? Why, when you're 15, things won't look at all the way they did when you were 10. And at 20, everything'll change again."
"I suppose so," replied Milo, for he'd never really thought about the matter.
"We always see things from the same angle," the boy continued. "It's much less trouble that way. Besides, it makes more sense to grow down and not up. When you're very young, you can never hurt yourself falling down if you're in mid-air, and you certainly can't get into trouble for scuffing up your shoes or marking the floor if there's nothing to scuff 'em on, and the floor is 3 feet away."
"That's very true," thought Tok, who wondered how the dogs in the family liked the arrangement.
"But there are many other ways to look at things," remarked the boy. "For instance, you had orange juice, boiled eggs, toast and jam and milk for breakfast," he said, turning to Milo. "And you're always worried about people wasting time," he said to Tok. "And you're almost never right about anything," he said, pointing at the humbug. "And when you are, it's usually an accident."
"A gross exaggeration," protested the furious bug, who didn't realize that so much was visible to the naked eye.
"Amazing," gasped Tok.
"How do you know all that?" asked Milo.
"Simple," he said proudly. I'm Alec Bings. I see through things. I can see whatever's inside, behind, around, covered by, or subsequent to anything else. In fact, the only thing I can't see is whatever happens to be right in front of my nose.
Isn't that a little inconvenient? Asked Milo, whose neck was becoming quite stiff from looking up.
It is a little, replied Alec, but it's quite important to know what lies behind things. And the family helps me take care of the rest. My father sees to things, my mother looks after things, my brother sees beyond things, my uncle sees the other side of every question, and my little sister Alice sees under things.
How can she see under things if she's all the way up there? Growled the humbug.
Well, added Alec, turning a neat cartwheel, whatever she can't see under, she overlooks.
Would it be possible for me to see something from up there? Asked Milo politely.
You could, said Alec, but only if you try very hard to look at things as an adult does.
Milo tried as hard as he could, and as he did, his feet floated slowly off the ground until he was standing in the air next to Alec Bings. He looked around very quickly and, an instant later, crashed back down to earth again.
Interesting, wasn't it? Asked Alec.
Yes, it was, agreed Milo, rubbing his head and dusting himself off. But I think I'll continue to see things as a child. It's not so far to fall.
A wise decision, at least for the time being, said Alec. Everyone should have his own point of view.
Isn't this everyone's point of view?
Asked Toc, looking around curiously.
Of course not, replied Alec, sitting himself down on nothing. It's only mine. And you certainly can't always look at things from someone else's point of view. For instance, from here, that looks like a bucket of water, he said, pointing to a bucket of water. But from an ant's point of view, it's a vast ocean. From an elephant's, just a cool drink. And to a fish, of course, it's home. So you see, the way you see things depends a great deal on where you look at them from. Now come along and I'll show you the rest of the forest.
He ran quickly through the air, stopping occasionally to beckon Milo, Toc, and the humbug along. And they followed as well as anyone who had to stay on the ground could.
Does everyone here grow the way you do?
Puffed Milo when he'd caught up.
Almost everyone, replied Alec.
And then he stopped a moment and thought.
Now and then, though, someone does begin to grow differently. Instead of down, his feet grow up toward the sky. But we do our best to discourage awkward things like that.
What happens to them? Insisted Milo.
Oddly enough, they often grow 10 times the size of everyone else, said Alec thoughtfully. And I've heard that they walk among the stars.
And with that, he skipped off once again toward the waiting woods. Chapter 10 A Colorful Symphony. As they ran, tall trees closed in around them and arched gracefully toward the sky. The late afternoon sunlight leaped lightly from leaf to leaf, slid along branches and down trunks, and dropped finally to the ground in warm, luminous patches. A soft glow filled the air with the kind of light that made everything look sharp and clear and close enough to reach out and touch. Alec raced ahead, laughing and shouting, but soon encountered serious difficulties, for while he could always see the tree behind the next one, he could never see the next one itself, and was continually crashing into it. After several minutes of wildly dashing about, they all stopped for a breath of air.
I think we're lost, panted the humbug, collapsing into a large berry bush.
Nonsense!
Shouted Alec from the high branch on which he sat.
"Do you know where we are?"
asked Milo.
"Certainly," he replied. "We're right here on this very spot. Besides, being lost is never a matter of not knowing where you are. It's a matter of not knowing where you aren't. And I don't care at all about where I'm not."
This was much too complicated for the bug to figure out, and Milo had just begun repeating it to himself when Alec said, "If you don't believe me, ask the giant." And he pointed to a small house tucked neatly between two of the largest trees. Milo and Tok walked up to the door, whose brass nameplate read simply, "The Giant," and knocked. "Good afternoon," said the perfectly ordinary-sized man who answered the door.
"Are you the giant?"
asked Tok doubtfully.
"To be sure," he replied proudly. "I'm the smallest giant in the world. What can I do for you?"
"Are we lost?" said Milo.
"That's a difficult question," said the giant. "Why don't you go around back and ask the midget?"
And he closed the door. They walked to the rear of the house, which looked exactly like the front, and knocked at the door, whose nameplate read, "The Midget."
"How are you?" inquired the man, who looked exactly like the giant.
"Are you the midget?"
asked Tok again, with a hint of uncertainty in his voice.
"Unquestionably," he answered. "I'm the tallest midget in the world. May I help you?"
"Do you think we're lost?" repeated Milo.
"That's a very complicated problem," he said. "Why don't you go around to the side and ask the fat man?"
And he, too, quickly disappeared.
The side of the house looked very like the front and back, and the door flew open the very instant they knocked.
"How nice of you to come by," exclaimed the man, who could have been the midget's twin brother.
"You must be the fat man," said Tok,
learning not to count too much on appearance.
"The thinnest one in the world," he replied brightly. "But if you have any questions, I suggest you try the thin man on the other side of the house."
Just as they suspected, the other side of the house looked the same as the front, the back, and the side, and the door was again answered by a man who looked precisely like the other three.
"What a pleasant surprise," he cried happily. "I haven't had a visitor in as long as I can remember."
"How long is that?" asked Milo.
"I'm sure I don't know," he replied. "Now pardon me, I have to answer the door."
"But you just did," said Tok.
"Oh, yes, I'd forgotten."
"Are you the fattest thin man in the world?" asked Tok.
"Do you know one that's fatter?" he asked impatiently.
"I think you're all the same man," said Milo emphatically.
"Shh," he cautioned, putting his finger up to his lips and drawing Milo closer.
"Do you want to ruin everything? You see, to tall men, I'm a midget, and to short men, I'm a giant. To the skinny ones, I'm a fat man, and to the fat ones, I'm a thin man. That way, I can hold four jobs at once. As you can see, though, I'm neither tall nor short nor fat nor thin. In fact, I'm quite ordinary. But there are so many ordinary men that no one asks their opinion about anything. Now, what's your question?"
"Are we lost?"
asked Milo once again.
Said the man, scratching his head. "I haven't had such a difficult question in as long as I can remember. Would you mind repeating it? It slipped my mind."
Milo asked the question for the fifth time.
"My, my," the man mumbled. "I know one thing for certain. It's much harder to tell whether you are lost than whether you were lost. For on many occasions, where you're going is exactly where you are. On the other hand, you often find that where you've been isn't at all where you should have gone.
And since it's much more difficult to find your way back from some place you've never left, I suggest you go there immediately and then decide. If you have any more questions, please ask the giant. And he slammed his door and pulled down the shade.
I hope you're satisfied,
said Alec when they'd returned from the house. And he bounced to his feet, bent down to awaken the snoring humbug, and started off, more slowly this time, in the direction of a large clearing.
Do many people live here in the forest?
Asked Milo as they trotted along together.
Oh, yes. They live in a wonderful city called Reality,
he announced, smashing into one of the smaller trees and sending a cascade of nuts and leaves to the ground.
It's right this way.
In a few more steps, the forest opened before them, and off to the left a magnificent metropolis appeared. The rooftops shone like mirrors, the walls glistened with thousands of precious stones, and the broad avenues were paved in silver.
Is that it?
Shouted Milo, running toward the shining streets.
Oh, no, that's only illusions, said Alec. The real city's over there.
What are illusions? Milo asked, for it was the loveliest city he'd ever seen.
Illusions, explained Alec, are like mirages.
And realizing that this didn't help much, he continued.
And mirages are things that aren't really there that you can see very clearly.
How can you see something that isn't there? Yawned the humbug, who wasn't fully awake yet.
Sometimes it's much simpler than seeing things that are, he said. For instance, if something's there, you can only see it with your eyes open. But if it isn't there, you can see it just as well with your eyes closed. That's why imaginary things are often easier to see than real ones.
Then where's reality?
Barked Tuck.
Right here, cried Alec, waving his arms. You're standing in the middle of Main Street.
They looked around very carefully. Tuck sniffed suspiciously at the wind, and the humbug gingerly stabbed his cane at the air. But there was nothing at all to see.
It's really a very pleasant city, said Alec, as he strolled down the street, pointing out several of the sights which didn't seem to be there,
and tipping his cap to the passers-by. There were great crowds of people rushing along with their heads down, and they all appeared to know exactly where they were going as they darted down and around the non-existent streets and in and out of the missing buildings.
I don't see any city, said Milo very softly. Neither do they,
Alec remarked sadly.
But it hardly matters, for they don't miss it at all.
It must be very difficult to live in a city you can't see, Milo insisted, jumping aside as a line of cars and trucks went by.
Not at all, once you get used to it, said Alec. But let me tell you how it happened.
And as they strolled along the bustling and busy avenue, he began.
Many years ago, on this very spot, there was a beautiful city of fine houses and inviting spaces, and no one who lived here was ever in a hurry. The streets were full of wonderful things to see, and people would often stop to look at them.
Didn't they have any place to go? Asked Milo.
To be sure, continued Alec. But as you know, the most important reason for going from one place to another is to see what's in between. And they took great pleasure in doing just that. Then one day, someone discovered that if you walked as fast as possible and looked at nothing but your shoes, you'd arrive at your destination much more quickly. Soon everyone was doing it. They all rushed down the avenues and hurried along the boulevard, seeing nothing of the wonders and beauties of their city as they went.
Milo remembered the many times he'd done the very same thing. And, as hard as he tried, there were even things on his own street that he couldn't remember.
No one paid any attention to how things looked. And as they moved faster and faster, everything grew uglier and dirtier.
And as everything grew uglier and dirtier, they moved faster and faster. And at last a very strange thing began to happen. Because nobody cared, the city slowly began to disappear. Day by day, the buildings grew fainter and fainter, and the streets faded away, until at last it was entirely invisible. There was nothing to see at all.
"What did they do?" the humbug inquired, suddenly taking an interest in things.
"Nothing at all," continued Alec. "They went right on living here just as they'd always done. In the houses they could no longer see, and on the streets which had vanished, because nobody had noticed a thing. And that's the way they've lived to this very day."
"Hasn't anyone told them?" asked Milo.
"It doesn't do any good," Alec replied, "for they can never see what they're in too much of a hurry to look for."
"Why don't they live in illusions?" suggested the humbug. "It's much prettier."
"Many of them do," he answered, walking in the direction of the forest once again. "But it's just as bad to live in a place where what you do see isn't there, as it is to live in one where what you don't see is. Perhaps someday you can have one city as easy to see as illusions and as hard to forget as reality," Milo remarked.
"That'll only happen when you bring back rhyme and reason," said Alec, smiling, for he'd seen right through Milo's plans.
"Now let's hurry, or we'll miss the evening concert."
They followed him quickly up a flight of steps which couldn't be seen, and through a door which didn't exist. In a moment, they'd left reality, which is sometimes a hard thing to tell, and stood in a completely different part of the forest. The sun was dropping slowly from sight, and stripes of purple and orange and crimson and gold piled themselves on top of the distant hills. The last shafts of light waited patiently for a flight of wrens to find their way home, and a group of anxious stars had already taken their places.
"Here we are," cried Alec. And with a sweep of his arm, he pointed toward an enormous symphony orchestra. "Isn't it a grand sight?"
There were at least 1,000 musicians ranged in a great arc before them. To the left and right were the violins and cellos, whose bows moved in great waves, and behind them, in numberless profusion, the piccolos, flutes, clarinets, oboes, bassoons, horns, trumpets, trombones, and tubas were all playing at once. At the very rear, so far away they could hardly be seen, were the percussion instruments. And lastly, in a long line up one side of a steep slope, were the solemn bass fiddles. On a high podium in front stood the conductor, a tall, gaunt man with dark, deep-set eyes and a thin mouth, placed carelessly between his long, pointed nose and his long, pointed chin. He used no baton, but conducted with large, sweeping movements, which seemed to start at his toes and work slowly up through his body and along his slender arms, and end finally at the tips of his graceful fingers.
"I don't hear any music," said Milo.
"That's right," said Alec. "You don't listen to this concert, you watch it. Now pay attention."
As the conductor waved his arms, he molded the air like handfuls of soft clay, and the musicians carefully followed his every direction.
"What are they playing?"
asked Toc, looking up inquisitively at Alec.
"The sunset, of course. They play it every evening about this time."
"They do?"
said Milo, quizzically.
"Naturally,"
answered Alec.
"And they also play morning, noon, and night. When, of course, it's morning, noon, or night. Why, there wouldn't be any color in the world unless they played it."
"Each instrument plays a different one," he explained.
and depending, of course, on what season it is and how the weather's to be, the conductor chooses his score and directs the day. But watch, the sun has almost set, and in a moment you can ask Chroma himself.
The last colors slowly faded from the western sky. And as they did, one by one the instruments stopped, until only the bass fiddles, in their somber, slow movement, were left to play the night, and a single set of silver bells brightened the constellations. The conductor let his arms fall limply at his sides, and stood quite still as darkness claimed the forest.
"That was a very beautiful sunset," said Milo, walking to the podium.
"It should be," was the reply. "We've been practicing since the world began."
And reaching down, the speaker picked Milo off the ground and set him on the music stand.
"I'm Chroma the Great," he continued, gesturing broadly with his hands. "Conductor of color, maestro of pigment, and director of the entire spectrum."
"Do you play all day long?" asked Milo, when he'd introduced himself.
"Ah, yes, all day, every day," he sang out, then pirouetted gracefully around the platform. "I rest only at night, and even then they play on."
"What would happen if you stopped?" asked Milo, who didn't quite believe that color happened that way.
"See for yourself," roared Chroma.
And he raised both hands high over his head. Immediately, the instruments that were playing stopped. And at once, all color vanished. The world looked like an enormous coloring book that had never been used. Everything appeared in simple black outlines. And it looked as if someone with a set of paints the size of a house and a brush as wide could stay happily occupied for years. Then Chroma lowered his arms. The instruments began again, and the color returned.
"You see what a dull place the world would be without color," he said, bowing until his chin almost touched the ground. "But what pleasure to lead my violins in a serenade of spring green, or hear my trumpets blare out the blue sea, and then watch the oboes tint it all in warm yellow sunshine. And rainbows are best of all, and blazing neon signs, and taxi cabs with stripes, and the soft, muted tones of a foggy day. We play them all."
As Chroma spoke, Milo sat with his eyes wide open, and Alec, Tok, and the humbug looked on in wonder.
"Now I really must get some sleep."
Chroma yawned.
"We've had lightning, fireworks, and parades for the last few nights, and I've had to be up to conduct them. But tonight is sure to be quiet."
Then, putting his large hand on Milo's shoulder, he said,
"Be a good fellow and watch my orchestra till morning, will you? And be sure to wake me at 5:23 for the sunrise. Good night, good night, good night."
With that, he leaped lightly from the podium and in three long steps vanished into the forest.
"That's a good idea," said Tok,
making himself comfortable in the grass, as the bug grumbled himself quickly to sleep, and Alec stretched out in midair. And Milo, full of thoughts and questions, curled up on the pages of tomorrow's music and eagerly awaited the dawn.
This ends Disc 2.